Today on the 21st Show, Alan Gelzo has written many award-winning books about the life and legacy of Abraham Lincoln. His latest is Our Ancient Faith, which explores Lincoln's ideas and beliefs about democracy and how they led him and America through the Civil War. Gelzo is scheduled to be in Springfield later this week, delivering the keynote address at the Abraham Lincoln Association's annual meeting. I'm Brian Mackey. We'll talk with Ellen Gelzo for the hour today on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WNIJ in Rockford DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, news. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Abraham Lincoln was born 217 years ago this week, and on Thursday, the Abraham Lincoln Association will gather in Springfield to mark the occasion, as it has every year since 1924. The keynote speaker this year is Alan Gelzo, one of our foremost Lincoln scholars. He's written roughly a dozen books on Lincoln and the Civil War era, including his most recent, Our Ancient Faith, Lincoln, Democracy, and the American Experiment. The title comes from Lincoln himself, who called the ideals of the Declaration of Independence our ancient faith. Gelzo's book asks a question that feels more urgent today than at any other moment in most of our lifetimes. What did Lincoln believe about democracy, and can those beliefs still guide us? We'll talk about Lincoln's understanding of the American Revolution, the tension between the Declaration and the Constitution, and what might have happened if Lincoln had survived to oversee Reconstruction. Alan Gelzo joins us now. He is a professor at the University of Florida's Hamilton School of Classical and Civic Education. Professor Gelzo, welcome to the 21st Show. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much. It's good to be able to talk to so many friends that I've had for many years in Illinois, the home of Abraham Lincoln.
Absolutely, and something that is embraced at the Abraham Lincoln Hotel, even, the banquet is. It's Lincoln's all the way down. So I mentioned this banquet coming up on Thursday. What drew you to the topic of Lincoln and the American Revolution?
Well, pretty obviously, we are in the midst of the anniversary of the Declaration of Independence and the Revolution. It's the 250th, and it seemed appropriate with that in view to talk about Lincoln's understanding, Lincoln's view, Lincoln's embrace of what happened in 1776. He once made the comment that he'd never had a thought politically that wasn't based upon, that didn't originate in the Declaration of Independence. He said that, in fact, on the premises where the Declaration of Independence was adopted and signed, which was Philadelphia's Independence Hall in February of 1861. And he went on to add something that by retrospect seems to us to be almost a little eerie. He said, rather than surrender those principles, the principles of the Declaration, the principles of the American Revolution, rather than surrender those principles, he said he would rather be assassinated on the spot. And knowing what would in fact happen only a little more than 4 years later, that puts a certain edge on those comments he makes about the priority of the Declaration. In fact, his body will lay in state there in that very same Independence Hall in April of 1865. So, yes, he was willing, and as it would turn out, he would in fact be assassinated for those principles, the ones that he believed were the root of everything he believed politically.
You describe Lincoln and the Revolution and the Declaration as having an almost religious power, right? He's holding his hands up when he's talking about it, palms out. As though at a revival. Describe that for us.
When Lincoln spoke, it was unusual among the great orators of his day because Lincoln spoke in a very high, piping voice. He didn't have an operatic baritone. And he had a very pronounced border state accent, so that people who heard him for the first time were a little bit puzzled because he just did not sound like a great orator. It was when people listened to what he had to say rather than the way it was delivered. That was what made the difference, because he was a man of great persuasion. After all, he'd been a trial lawyer for all of his professional life. And he was used to the notion that his obligation was to persuade people. So even when you read Lincoln in cold type after more than 160 years, you're still impressed by the man's persuasive energy, his persuasive power. He wants to bring you around to his point of view. Other people in Lincoln's day, other great orators, would use emotional, passionate appeals to convince people. But Lincoln was very much a man of reason. He wanted to put that logical hook into people's mouths and then use that to reel them in. And it's very rare that you find him being described as or remarked upon as being particularly worked up on the speaking platform. But when he talked about the Declaration, that was a different story. That was one of the exceptional moments. And his partner, his law partner of many years, William Henry Herndon, said that when Lincoln would start talking about the Declaration of Independence, that was when he got excited. His hands would go up, his whole face would light up, and you would be looking at someone that you were convinced was talking about someone who'd had an experience that almost bordered on a kind of religious embrace, a kind of religious conversion. And in fact, when Lincoln does talk about the Declaration, so often when he speaks of it, it's connected with a kind of New Testament vocabulary. So he talks about our ancient faith. He talks about how we have to find this principle of equality, which in his day he said had become soiled. We have to wash that white in the blood of the revolution. And there he's using phraseology, which comes straight out of the New Testament. And you find this in many places. When Lincoln starts talking about the Declaration of Independence, it's almost a kind of holy writ for him to appeal to.
What did he understand the core principles of 1776 to be, of the revolution to be?
He would start by saying that, first of all, what the revolution was about establishing the fact that sovereignty in any kind of polity, any kind of social or political organization, sovereignty, the authority to set policy, the authority to make decisions, that has to come from the people. This is being said by Lincoln in a day when, in many places in the world, you still function by the principle of hierarchy, that authority or sovereignty started at the top with a king or with an emperor or someone like that, and then only worked its way down to the people. Lincoln has a totally different view of this, because what he finds in the Declaration is the erasure, the abolition of this notion of hierarchy. Instead, authority, sovereignty, that starts with the people themselves, and the people then delegate that sovereignty. How do they do it? Well, this is the second thing. They do it through elections. And elections are there not just as a kind of political entertainment that we have every 2 or 4 years to amuse ourselves with. Rather, for him, elections are, first of all, they're about choosing who is going to be responsible for carrying out the will, the sovereignty of the people. But those elections are also a reminder to those who are already in political office that they're accountable. And they're accountable to the people. They don't have authority of their own, simply to make their own decisions by their own whim and to do anything that pleases them. No, elections are always a tap on the shoulder. Remember, you are representing the will of the people. So for him, elections are a great moment. If anybody had an excuse for canceling an election, then surely it would have been Abraham Lincoln in the midst of the Civil War, When he in 1864 is facing the every 4 year trial of a political candidate, and that is in his case his re-election to the presidency, we could possibly have rationalized to ourselves the idea that the Civil War was such a great national emergency that he could at least have put that presidential election on pause. I mean, who in the midst of a great civil war is going to run the risk of the instability of a change of government? So we might be able to step back and say, well, 1864, it's a civil war. There's an exceptional situation that's at work here. And maybe we could forgive Lincoln. If Lincoln announced, well, we're going to put off the national election for another year, or we're going to put it off until the Civil War is over. And that thought never even seems to have crossed his mind. He submits to the trial of re-election. And in his case, he's successful. He's re-elected. But he says afterwards, if we had not had this election, if for some reason we had canceled it or postponed it or qualified it in some way, in the name of saying that, well, there's a war on, there's an emergency. If we had done that, he said, that would have been like giving away the entire game of the Civil War to those who had caused it in the first place, which is to say, the Southern Confederacy. We would have been conceding that our government really doesn't work under stress. And that, he said, would have defeated the whole purpose of the principles for which we're fighting. So he takes this notion of elections very, very seriously, because elections have to be there. They are the essence of accountability in a free government. There's a third thing, too. In elections, what decides an election? Well, we've never yet seen an election where everybody voted the same way. There's no such thing as a 100% election. There's no event, at least none that I know of, in which the conclusion of the election has simply been that 100% of the people go in one way. That doesn't happen. So you're always in an election going to get majorities and minorities. For Lincoln, the majorities, by simple authority of the fact that they are the majority in the people, they have the right to rule. They have the right to set policy. Now, for him, what's important here is that doesn't mean that they have the authority to suppress minorities. It doesn't mean they have the authority, if they win the election, that they can take the people of an opposing party or an opposing faction, or even the people who voted for the other candidate in general. There's no authority there for majorities to put them up against a barn wall and shoot them. No, that's not what majority rule is about. So majorities rule, but they don't suppress the people who disagree, who oppose. Minorities, likewise, minorities have the obligation to yield to the rule of the majority. But that doesn't mean that they have the right to try to sabotage what the majority proceeds to do afterwards. Minorities can dissent, but they don't have the right to subvert. And this, he really thought, was one of the essential principles that was at stake in the Civil War. Because what else had happened in 1860? But that he had been elected president by the constitutional rules, and a minority decided, no, we're not going to go along with that. We're going to walk out. We're not just going to take this quietly. We are going to leave completely, and we're going to call our leaving the Confederate States of America. And that, he said, that is what gave us this Civil War. Worse than that, that is what persuades every king, every emperor, every dictator, that democracies really don't work. Democracies, after all, are full of minorities and majorities. But if minorities say to the majority, look, we're just not going to go along, we didn't like the results, we lost, we disagree, we're gone. What kind of a democracy do you have then? You don't have democratic government at all, and the American Revolution really was for nothing. And then the fourth thing, and that for him is the importance of law. In the first big speech that he gives, the first speech that gets itself published in the newspapers, which we sometimes call the Lyceum speech, because it was delivered to the Young Men's Lyceum of Springfield in 1838. And in that speech, he talks about a great deal about the revolution. But what was one of the great gifts of the revolution? It was law. Because law is the fourth great thing that operates as our inheritance from the revolution, the rule of law. Law is what keeps reason in control. It keeps it in a central position in our decision making. Otherwise, without law, reason becomes mob rule, and mob rule, he said, leads to anarchy, and anarchy leads to despotism. In that Lyceum speech, he said, "Is it likely that the United States could ever be conquered by a foreign power?" "No," he said. "Ridiculous. They'd never get beyond the Appalachians." But then he says, "There is a threat to our future, but it comes from within. And that threat comes from the moment we set law aside and we become a mob." Because a mob feels like at that moment it's asserting itself, that it's in charge, that it has power. But in fact, in a very short while, mob rule grinds on everyone else, and everyone else starts looking around for someone who's going to restore order. And that's when they turn to a Napoleon Bonaparte. That's when they turn to a dictator. So if we are going to really be the heirs of the revolution, he said, if we're really going to stand in that line of descent from the American Revolution and the Declaration of Independence, we have to be a people of law, because if we are not going to allow ourselves to be ruled by law, then it's going to descend into anarchy, and anarchy is going to yield to dictatorship. So for him, those are the four great
Yes.
lessons that we take out of the revolution.
And that is an excellent timing. We need to take a break on the program. We will continue our conversation with Alan Gelzo in a moment. He is coming to Springfield later this week, giving the keynote address at the Abraham Lincoln Association's annual banquet. More to come here on the 21st Show. We'll be right back. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking today with Lincoln scholar Alan Gelzo. He's giving the keynote address at this year's Abraham Lincoln Association annual banquet. That's this Thursday at the President Lincoln Hotel in Springfield. You can join us at 800-222-9455. I wonder what Lincoln's vision of democracy means to you today, and if your understanding of Lincoln has changed over time. Maybe you have one question you might like to ask Lincoln about America in 2026. 800-222-9455 is the number to join us today. 800-222-9455. So in your book, you spend time on the concept of mores, right? The shared assumptions, the habits that sort of undergird democratic self-government. Talk to me about that idea.
The term mores, of course, is a French term, and it was made a popular item of discussion and has been ever since the days of Alexis de Tocqueville, writing in his great book, Democracy in America. Tocqueville was a Frenchman paying a visit to the United States. He was in the United States for several months in the 1830s, and he wrote a book afterwards about democracy. And Brian, it is extraordinary. You pick this book up from a man who did not grow up in the United States, only was a visitor to America, and he's writing this in 1830, but you pick that book up today, you open it up and you read it, and it's like reading a description of the world right around you. Tocqueville was so prescient about understanding American democracy. So Tocqueville's Democracy in America is really one of the great books about America, and yet not written by an American. And I have often wondered what might have been the result if Tocqueville had met Abraham Lincoln. Now, Tocqueville is in the United States in the 1830s. So the Lincoln he would have met in the 1830s would have been the surveyor, the postmaster, maybe the newly elected state legislator, from New Salem, Illinois. So he might not have been terribly impressed by what he met at that point, but it certainly would have been an interesting moment. Because one thing that they share is this sense that there are a number of habits that democracies flourish with. And I think there are many ways in which Lincoln is a good example of those habits, those mores. I mean, Tocqueville's using the French term, I'll use the term habit as well. And I think the best way to start in understanding that is first of all, to understand that Lincoln was not what we might today call a populist. Lincoln, if we can judge by the Lyceum speech from 1838, Lincoln is trying, in fact, to put distance between himself and populism because he associates populism with this weakness for mob rule, mob action, for impulse, for passion. Lincoln is very much the man of reason, very much a product, you might say, of the 18th century Enlightenment, just as Jefferson and Madison and Washington were products of that. He is, in the 1830s, dealing in a new cultural environment that puts a higher priority on passion and impulse. And you see this in the man who was president while Lincoln is establishing himself in the 1830s, and that's Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson is a populist. And he does function quite frequently by passion and by impulse and by whim. And he makes what even today read as some fairly shocking appeals to the prejudices of the mobs. And Lincoln distanced himself from that. So he's not a populist. But at the same time, he's not an elitist either. Because Abraham Lincoln comes to political office and even to the presidency with none of the credentials that we often like to assume with an elitist. I mean, he never goes to college. That was something that he regretted years later because he knew that put him at a disadvantage in terms of people who evaluate by credentials. But he doesn't have those credentials. In fact, when he's a this is an interesting thing. When he's elected president, he's really never had any executive experience. He's never been the governor of Illinois. He tried twice to get elected senator, U.S. senator from Illinois, but did not succeed on either occasion. He's never even been the mayor of his hometown of Springfield. And now suddenly he's going to be president of the United States. But what makes him successful, shall we say, what makes him memorable are the mores, the qualities, the habits that he had, which turn out to be just exactly the things that dovetail with political life in a democracy. Because what you find in Lincoln is, first of all, resilience. Here's a man who can absorb punishment, he can absorb disagreement, and he can work with disagreement. He also manifests a surprising amount of humility. Now, it's not the humility which is always indulged in what you might call humble brag. No, this is genuine humility. This is a man who understands his place in things, understands he's not competent to every possible situation you could imagine, who is willing to listen to disagreement, willing to consider alternatives, willing to joke about himself. As one of the more remarkable things that people said about Lincoln was that here was a man who could poke fun at himself and especially at his appearance, which I know that today we are so familiar with Abraham Lincoln from the Lincoln Memorial or the $5 bill. But Brian, look, in his own day, when people met him, they were a little bit put off because he was as homely as an old fence post out in the back pasture. And he knew it, and he made jokes about himself that way. He could do that. He could do that. He had, in addition to that humility, he had the humor that, in fact, could tell a good joke and sometimes turn a good joke to good purposes. Because it was often said that Lincoln had a tremendous fund of stories, but the stories almost always had a point to them. They would illustrate something. He also had among this collection of habits or mores, he had a desire for the general good, for submission to that general good. He once said about one of his most difficult generals, George McClellan, "I would hold McClellan's horse if he would only give us victories." And I don't think he was really exaggerating at that moment. Later on, in the same year that he makes that comment, he writes to a Unionist in Louisiana, where Union forces have already begun to occupy part of this state, which had been one of the original states of the Confederacy. This Louisiana Unionist, Cuthbert Bullitt, had written to Lincoln to complain about the way Union soldiers were behaving. And Lincoln writes back to him and says, "Look, you shouldn't be complaining. Louisiana asked for this by trying to leave the Union." But then Lincoln concludes the letter and he says, "I shall do nothing in malice. What I am dealing with is too great for malicious dealing." And what a remarkable statement that is from a president of the United States writing to an individual citizen. Even more, you can see this in how he dealt with a potential rival. Because General Ulysses Grant, who emerges as the great Union general of the war, in 1863 did not have what you might call a predictable political pattern. People were not sure what side of the political fence he was going to come down on. And after the great victory he achieves at Vicksburg in July of 1863, there's some anxiety that Lincoln's opponents might put him up as a rival candidate for the presidency the following year. Lincoln writes to Grant, and what he says is one of the most remarkable things that a president ever writes to a general who is reporting to him as commander in chief. He says, "When you started out on your campaign against Vicksburg, I really thought you should have gone down river to assist General Banks at Baton Rouge. And when instead you crossed the Mississippi and began this campaign on the same side of the river as Vicksburg, I wasn't sure. I think you should have gone in another direction. But now everything has turned out that you were right and I was wrong." And he writes this letter and he says this to Grant. And I'm thinking, when can I remember a president who writes a letter like that to someone that it's not entirely sure he might be facing one day as a political opponent? That speaks to a great quality in Lincoln. And it is qualities like that, mores like that, which set apart politics in a democracy. In a monarchy, Brian, in a monarchy, what really counts is honor, appearance, domination, control, conquest. That's what makes monarchs admired. Or in a bureaucracy, what makes a bureaucracy admired, if in fact we admire bureaucracies, what makes them admirable? Efficiency, getting things done on schedule, behaving according to the job description. But political life in a democracy calls for different qualities. And the kinds of qualities, the kinds of mores, the kinds of habits that make for great democratic life are precisely the things that we find in Lincoln. If we want to offer a model type of what political life and political mores in a democracy should be like, it seems to me that I'm not just responding as a Lincoln person when I say that Lincoln may, in fact, offer us the best example of this in the history of American democracy.
Let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We're speaking with Alan Gelzo, noted Lincoln scholar. He's giving the keynote address at this year's Abraham Lincoln Association banquet, Thursday in Springfield. You can join us at 800-222-9455. And let's go now to the phones. Paul is calling from Urbana, Illinois, on line one. Paul, thank you for calling in.
Yeah, I want to go back into his period in the legislature when he opposed the Mexican-American War. This is provoked because Trump issued something about the Mexican-American War last Thursday that was total misrepresentationally based. And I looked into it and I found out things I didn't know, which was there are the famous spotism discourses that Lincoln gave. And basically, he was saying, Polk, prove where this incursion that was the casus belli for the attack on Mexico happened. So it looks like it's another Gulf of Tonkin, it's another WMDs, it's a fake casus belli. I don't know the substance of it, but Lincoln was on that side, and he opposed the expansion of slavery by this expansionism that was generated by the Mexican-American War. This is an untold chapter in Lincoln. Everybody focuses on the Civil War and argues about what his motivations were, really. You know, I attended one of these talks that you're giving in the past, and they hosted the famous scholar who wrote the book Forced into Glory, which is very controversial about Lincoln, and I'm sure you could probably spend the rest of the time. That's Lerone Bennett Jr. It's a bestseller in the African American community, but the arguments aren't very presented. But I was provoked to be about the Mexican American War stance that Lincoln gave.
All right, Paul, thank you so much for the call. I appreciate it. Dr. Gelzo, I need to warn you, we need to take another break in about 3 minutes. But if you have anything to say.
All right. I'm going to take the risk of simplifying, which maybe isn't what Paul wants to hear, but all right, I'm going to try. The Mexican-American War, Lincoln accuses President Polk, and he's very frank about this. You know, Lincoln has just been elected as a Whig to Congress. Polk is a Democrat, not only a Democrat, but the heir of Andrew Jackson. And Lincoln accuses Polk, in the most general sense, of being responsible for starting the Mexican War as a means, as a vehicle of expanding the power of slavery in the North American continent. I mean, remember that at the outbreak of the Mexican War, the Mexican Republic is still ruling over what today is constituted by Arizona, New Mexico, California, Nevada, parts of Colorado, all of that great section that lay south of the Louisiana Purchase. So there is a card up Polk's sleeve. But there's a specific objection that Lincoln has, and that is this immediate justification that Polk offers, that the Mexican army attacked United States forces on their side of the Rio Grande. And that was really the nub of a major disagreement, because Texas was originally a Mexican province. It rebelled against Mexico in 1835 and achieved a kind of de facto independence, set itself up as an independent republic, and then was annexed by the United States in 1845. The Mexicans never really recognized the independence of Texas, were never really pleased at the annexation of Texas by the United States, and above all, they didn't agree as to where the boundary was. Was it the Rio Grande River? Was it the Rio Nueces? And Polk provokes this by sending United States troops down to the Rio Grande and almost daring the Mexicans to do something about it, which of course they did. Conflict breaks out, shots are exchanged, there are casualties, and that becomes the excuse that Polk has for the war. Lincoln stands up in Congress and says, I want to know the spot where that encounter occurred, because he believes he can prove that that spot really was not American territory, that was really Mexican territory. And then from that set of spot resolutions, that gives Lincoln a nickname among his political opponents as Spotty Lincoln. And they will accuse him of not being supporting an American war. He will insist afterwards that, no, he voted for supplies for the troops. He was doing his diligence that way. What he was disagreeing about was President Polk's high-handed action in triggering this conflict in the first place. And I hope I got that into 3 minutes, Brian.
You did it perfectly. perfectly well. We are going to take another break. We will return with more from Alan Gelzo after a short break. His most recent book, 2024, on Lincoln is called Our Ancient Faith, Lincoln, Democracy, and the American Experiment. He's giving a keynote address at the Abraham Lincoln Association banquet later this week. More to come. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are speaking today with Professor Alan Gelzo. He's at the Hamilton School of Classical and Civic Education at the University of Florida. He's the author of roughly a dozen books on Lincoln, Gettysburg, the Lincoln-Douglas debates, the Emancipation Proclamation. His most recent Lincoln book is from 2024, Our Ancient Faith, Lincoln, Democracy, and the American Experiment. He's going to be in Springfield Thursday for the Abraham Lincoln Association's annual birthday celebration. You can join us at 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. So I want to return to the Declaration, which promised that all men are created equal. The Constitution provides for a right of property in man. Talk to me about how Lincoln navigated the tension between those two documents.
Actually, one of the things the Constitution was careful not to do was to establish a right of property in man. And this shows up in the way the delegates to the Constitutional Convention talked about slavery. Madison, especially, insisted that the text of the Constitution, even where it has at some points to recognize that there is this thing called slavery, wants to make it clear that the Constitution itself is not going to talk about there being such a thing as property in man or property in men, as Roger Sherman also added. In fact, one of the things that both Sherman and Madison thought were admirable about the Constitution was how they avoided that, how they used euphemisms to talk about slavery. And why? Why? Well, two reasons, basically. One is they had a large component of delegates in that Constitutional Convention who were themselves slave owners, although ironically, several of those slave owners were also the ones who were the most opposed to giving any kind of recognition to slavery in the Constitution. But there were at least two states whose delegations made it clear that if there was any effort to tamper directly with slavery in the Constitution, then they would not go along with the creation of this American Union. And if they didn't, then people could see nothing beyond that except the complete dissolution of this American experiment, maybe even reconquest and recolonization by Britain, and maybe not just by Britain, maybe our erstwhile allies, the French, would also look to have a part of the American states, maybe the Spanish. So there was a real fear. If we kick this sleeping dog, it might bite. So the decision was, all right, we're not going to kick it. We're going to talk about slavery, but we're going to use euphemisms about it. So we're going to talk about people held to service, which could mean juveniles who are under an apprentice contract. Could mean people like that. It's enough of a euphemism that a lot of things can be served by that. Having put that into the Constitution that way, it's there largely because, and you see this again from the discussions that take place in the convention, because the bulk of these delegates are embarrassed by slavery and its existence in America. It's something they want to blame on the British. This is something we inherit from Britain. And they have an expectation that in the American environment, this is something which is going to go away on its own. It's already, as they thought, decreasing in its influence and its numbers. What's going to happen in the future is, and in fact, several of the delegates, like Oliver Ellsworth, actually make this prediction that free labor is, in a short order, it's going to completely eliminate slavery. Slavery is going to be economically unjustifiable, not to mention being morally and politically unjustifiable. And we're not even going to have to worry about it, and nobody will need to know there ever was such a thing. That was the expectation of the convention. And in large measure, That for a long period of Lincoln's life is his expectation as well. He says this: I always believed that slavery was on the path to what he called ultimate extinction, because he believed that this is an unjust system. It's an unjust system that produces unfair and disappointing results economically, politically, and every which way. So it's eventually it's the disharmony between slavery and this experiment founded on the basis of the Declaration of Independence, that the disharmony between it is going to become so great, it's going to eventually disappear. That is why Lincoln will, very early in his political career, put himself on record as opposed to slavery when, in fact, he is elected to Congress and sits in the House of Representatives. He really believes that it's time to take some action about banning the sale of slaves in the District of Columbia, a great embarrassment as far as he was concerned for the American government. But he really believes that all you really have to do is to build a kind of Berlin Wall around the slave states. Don't trigger any disaster by trying to interfere directly, but just build that brick wall, because slavery, in order to continue, is going to require expansion. Deny it expansion, it'll die out on its own. And he believes that straight up until 1854. He believes that, all right, he's opposed to slavery, he thinks it's wrong, but look, it's going to die out on its own. And we don't have to take the chance, we don't have to take the risk of what might happen if we try to do something directly. 1854 changes that, because that's the year of the Kansas-Nebraska Act. And the Kansas-Nebraska Act is what opens the door for the possible legalization of slavery in all of the Western territories, and that includes especially the Louisiana Purchase. And then, if you're going to legalize slavery in those territories, or even if it's just legalizing the possibility of slavery in those territories, they're going to turn into states. And if they're slave states, they're going to bring their votes to Congress. And then what you're going to find is that instead of slavery being on the path of ultimate extinction, the fact slavery is going to push the other way, and it's going to be freedom and liberty that are on the path to extinction. And that is what motivates, that's what triggers Abraham Lincoln's reemergence in politics on the national stage, and which in 6 years will lead to his election as the 16th president. So he understands that what goes on with the Declaration and the Constitution is speaking to an expectation on the part of the founders, but it's an expectation that gets perverted, that gets undermined. And what he has to do from 1854 onwards is to stamp out that perversion and put things back on the track that he believes the founders had originally intended.
How does he, why is he different from the founder? Is he, is circumstance of his time in that he's able to see these contradictions that some of them perhaps chose to ignore in their own lives even?
For Lincoln, he understands that there are contradictions, and contradictions even in his own political career. Even up till 1860 and his election, even in fact up until the day of his inauguration on the 4th of March, 1861, he will do what he thinks he can do to placate the resistance and the agitation of slave owners in the southern states. He will, even in his first inaugural address, offer to endorse a 13th Amendment to the Constitution, not the 13th Amendment we understand as the 13th Amendment, but a 13th Amendment based on a plan which would have promised to the southern slaveholding states that there would be no interference by the national government in their ownership of slaves. Now, that to us sounds like a stupendous giveaway on Lincoln's part. And he's been criticized in succeeding generations for that. Now, there are two things I think to bear in mind. One is that in endorsing such an amendment, he was actually not giving the southern states anything they didn't already have. They already had an understood guarantee that the federal government would not meddle in slavery in those states because the federal government was the federal government. Its sphere of operation was on the federal level. It didn't have the authority to deal with slavery in the states. Because remember, slavery is legal in the states on the basis of state laws, not on the basis of laws passed by the federal government. There's no federal slave code. There's no federal legalization of slavery. So, in a sense, the Southerners already had that guarantee, and they knew that too, which is why, despite the fact that he makes this offer of a 13th Amendment in his inaugural address, none of them take it. They continue to careen towards secession and civil war because they know very well this isn't going to work out in our benefit. They can read those tea leaves. So Lincoln is offering to make concessions, but it's concessions that are always very limited. They are concessions that will head off trouble without giving the slave owners what they really want, which is a title to the future. That he will not cooperate with. And he says to everybody who will listen to him in the run-up to his inauguration as president, there must be no expansion of slavery into the territories. That's the limit. Can't go past that, can't weaken on that. As soon as he has said that, slave owners conclude, he is not our friend. It's time for us to get out of the Union while we still can, which they do, and thus we have a civil war.
Unfortunately, we have just a few minutes left in our time together today. I want to ask you, sort of in conclusion, what 160, 161 almost years after Lincoln's death, we're still grappling with these questions of democracy and mores and equality and race. I wonder if there is a succinct, unfortunately, idea you want to take away from Lincoln's example today for the struggles we're going through right now in America.
I would go back to those qualities, those mores that we talked about, Brian, because democracies need those qualities in their leaders. Not so much because of the leaders or for the sake of the leaders themselves, but because the things that I was describing as attributes of Lincoln are really the qualities of democracy itself. If we want to know how to sustain our democracy, then Lincoln is a good place to begin, not just for the leaders, but I think for ourselves as well. How do we cultivate this respect for law? How do we cultivate this balance between majorities and minorities? How do we value elections? How do we understand the authority of the people? These are ways in which democracies thrive. And Lincoln shows us, I think, in so many instances, how that thriving can take place. If we want a model, I would take us over and over and over again back to Abraham Lincoln himself, because Lincoln gives us a pattern, he gives us a model. And above all, he gives us an inspiration because, Brian, at the end of the day, Lincoln worked. He was cut down at the very end, but he had laid the foundation for the renewal and the preservation of the American democracy. Nothing seemed more likely in 1861 but that this democracy would fall apart. Because that's what democracies are supposed to do. Democracies are supposed to be great ideas in theory, but in practice, nobody really can get along that well or for that long. And Lincoln shows us, no. No, they can get along. They can be durable. Here are the ways to do it. If I have to put it into one sentence, it would be this. What would Lincoln do? WWLD. What would Lincoln do politically? In a given situation, in a given place, and a given time. And I think from that, we would actually draw some extraordinary inspiration for government of the people, by the people, for the people.
Alan Gelzo, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st show.
Very good.
Alan Gelzo is a professor at the University of Florida's Hamilton School. His most recent Lincoln book is Our Ancient Faith, Lincoln, Democracy, and the American Experiment. He'll be delivering the keynote address this Thursday at the Abraham Lincoln Association's annual banquet in Springfield. That is all the time we have for our program today. Coming up tomorrow, Tristan Otone is a member of the Kiowa Native American tribe, current editor-at-large at Grist. He's written about the Morrill Act and how land-grant institutions across the country have benefited from land taken from Indian tribes without due compensation. We'll speak with him ahead of a lecture he's set to give at the University of Illinois, a land-grant institution. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.